Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working at
an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, welcome to Party Friday, Chuck Bonneville, Julie Hayden, Chuck and Julie Grassroots Show. True straight up.
That's right. The show brought to you by Mountain West Wellness, Advanced Acupuncture, and Chinese Medicine. Coming up in a second, we're going to be talking to Professor Bruce Gilley. He's a political science professor at Portland State University, has an interesting review of the Sand Creek massacre exhibit at the History Colorado Museum. We're waiting for him. Okay. I know, hey, talking to Thomas here. Thomas, try again. He knows that we were going to be calling him. So the other thing we wanted to talk about, we talked about it a little bit on the other day about the letter that, and Dave Williams is on the show talking about.
Which will not find out anywhere locally anywhere.
No, huh? The letter that
predicted by yours truly.
That's right. Exactly. That the current leadership of the Colorado GOP sent to the previous establishment leadership, Christy Brown.
Letter of preservation. It was by an attorney, Randy Corcoran, who we all know.
Right. And Chuck, we'll talk about this a little bit more, but while we're waiting to get Bruce on the phone, one of the things, so what it all stems from a financial scandal that was uncovered by the current leadership. One of the things that Christy Burton Brown said, we have, what I think they told them, they had $100,000 plus in the Colorado Republican Party account, and that everything was in great order. So to say that the transition, I think it's fair to say the transition was sabotaged, actually, from Christie's transition to Dave's transition.
Well, you know, the prior transition, which came from our favorite congressman, who was the head,
Ken Buck,
they left him, I don't know, $300,000, $400,000. But so when Christie said, I left you $100,000, not so much.
Well, and so then
she left him far less, almost no cash, but lots of debts.
Right. And what they found out is that they had not been paying the rent. They'd been paying themselves $45,000 in bonuses, not clear to who. The payroll.
Not paying attorney's fees, or at least new attorney's fees.
Right. And they were, they were charging medical premiums, all kinds of stuff. And then the payroll company refuses to give the information to the current leadership. I mean, a whole lot of questions about it. Right. And I think that Dave and those guys have given them plenty of time to address it, which of course they don't, even though bizarrely what they do say is they attack Dave, right? By saying that he's not doing anything and that he can't raise money and that he's the one not paying the bills, right? And so finally what they did, and what they turned over is clearly civil issues, and I would say arguably criminal issues, right? If you are somebody was charging thousands and they believe they know who, thousands and thousands of dollars on the state GOP credit card for personal stuff, I think for their business probably, right? After they were no longer working there. I mean, if I had like a Chuck and Julie credit card and I quit the Chuck and Julie show
and
continued charging the credit card, that's fraud, right? You can't keep doing that, particularly since no one even knew you had the credit card in the first place. Well, nobody of the new people. So anyway, so finally what they did is they went ahead and they wrote a letter because Dave has made it clear. He said,
what's a letter of preservation? Preservation of evidence. You sent a letter saying, do you please do not destroy any of these records because we're going to be engaged in litigation and it'll be subject to discovery. There's always a question people have. Well, just because some jerk attorney writes you, why do you have to do anything? Well, that's the rules. The rules say that if you destroy it, then presumptions can be made by the court that you, in fact, were hiding evidence, and you may have to concede points that you claim are not true. So it can have pretty serious consequences, other times not.
Well, and let me just read a little bit. He said, and one of the reasons Dave is doing that is because the establishment, which is annoyed that it's been taken out of power, is trying to cause problems for the current people so that they can't raise money, right? They want to raise questions about...
Well, they knew that all the big donors, the big rhino donors, would not contribute anymore. So the key to discrediting the new ones is make sure they had no money, pretend they had money, and then basically leave them in debt.
Right.
And so that was, I think, the scheme.
Right.
You know, of course, all the Colorado Power, all the Anschutz publications, they, oh, yeah.
Well, they ignore it. Well, and here's what Randy
said. They didn't ignore it when she got out. They all reported that she left them, you know.
Right. They reported her lies, right? And so they're not. But here's, so in part, this is what Randy's letter said. The Colorado Republican Committee Party has asked me to send the following as a result of claims of potential malfeasance and financial irregularities during your tenure as chair from 2021 to 2023. These claims are based upon allegations including misappropriation of party resources, deceiving members, improper accounting, and potential unjust enrichments. This letter is to formally demand the preservation and relinquishment of certain evidence identified below. And I got to wonder, for some reason, they seem fairly confident that Christie has this. And I'm not sure how they would be, but they...
I'm not sure why they think it even.
And they've also said, and if you're not the person who has it, then you have to tell us who has it, right, and then direct that person to give it to us. And you have to hand over all of this evidence by December 27th, which is right, kind of it. That's like, you know, what, a couple of weeks, you know? Yeah, exactly. And so can you explain, because that was my question too. If I'm Christie Burton Brown, I mean, I think I'd be tempted to go and throw it away, but she can't do that, can she?
Well, she does not have to turn over anything.
She can argue about that.
Well, it's not a subpoena.
Right.
And there's no lawsuit. So there's no, you know, obligation to turn over evidence just because somebody sends you a letter. But because of the evidentiary rules, they have ruled if after getting this letter, you destroy information, the trial court can make assumptions and rulings based on your destroying evidence.
And we had some experience of this when I was a TV reporter. It would not be, I mean, it didn't happen all the time, but on occasion it would happen where somebody would want a copy of the story or something like that. And rarely did it go to, like, never in my experience, at least for me, did it actually go to court, but it wasn't, you know, unheard of that you would get a letter saying preserve it. Right.
Yes, yes.
And every so often then the news director would be like, maybe let's get rid of it right away. And then the attorneys would be like, no, mm-hmm. You don't want to do that. We'll have to argue about it in court. So, but I mean, Dave made it clear. I think the words he used was, we're going to escalate this, right? And the words, meaning that they're going to definitely pursue civil charges if she doesn't come up with an explanation, right? And then they're also...
I'm not sure they're asking for an explanation. They've asked an explanation before. They're asking for documents, which, once again, this is not a subpoena, so they don't have to turn over the records, but they do. They destroy them. That could be result in penalties and assumptions in court about the veracity of various statements.
Right. Well, and again, and pursue criminal complaint too. Now, I know there've been some people out there. We've heard a little bit of rumblings. So it's like, well, why not go straight to the criminal? And I think they probably, number one, want to see what her response is and what, if anything, they turn over. Right. Because you would think that Chrissy could say, oh, gall, sorry, Dave. It was just, you know, I was in a bad mood. And so we just kept all the stuff. I'm sorry. But now I see you guys are serious and you really should have it, because it should have just transferred over to you. It wasn't my personal stuff, right? It should have just transferred over to you. And so I'll just give it to you, right? Which probably...
Well, she has said in various things, we turned over 9 months ago. We don't have anything. What are you talking about? So there's that.
Interestingly, Dave noted that they had been able to recover files and emails that were deleted. Right. And so that is how they know about a lot of this stuff. And that is how they know that there is stuff that Christie has not turned over. Right. Because
they don't know, but they have strong suspicion, I imagine is a better word.
Okay. So anyway, this is, I think, and again, the astonishing radio silence. This is serious, right? Back to why they aren't going directly criminal. I think that's the kind of thing, once they have the information, I mean, they don't just, they can make a complaint, right? They can make a criminal complaint, and then the police would decide what to do about the whole thing.
And the DA. But you have to remember, once you do that, you've lost all control.
Right, right.
You know, your choices are wiser up at this, up at the state level. Is it, you know, highly a partisan Democrat? You could go to the Arapahoe County DA, Kellner, who is very much an ally of Christy Burton Brown.
Right.
And I suppose maybe you could go to the police chief, and but that would probably go up to Kellner anyway. So you lose all control. You know, it just goes into a black hole, and you never see it again. At least if you civilly charge somebody,
exactly,
you're in control. You know the court is requiring you to do things, requiring them to do things. You at least still have control over it rather than just going into the black box of the judicial system.
Well, and not only that, but if you file a criminal complaint and the police take it up, now everything is under investigation, right?
Right.
So you can't, Christy Burton Brown understandably wouldn't want to be deposed. I mean, that would bring to a halt, a screeching halt, any kind of civil process too. What kind of things could they sue for?
I mean, restitution, return of the money, damages for financial fraud, for filing reports with the FEC that were false and knowingly false. They could file for negligent supervision of employees who took funds unlawfully without supervision.
There's a whole slew of things.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so anyway, so we will keep track of that. Again, I do find it interesting. You would think normally the liberal puppet media would be happy to report on problems within the Colorado Republican Party. And to me, it's interesting how far they're willing to go to protect Christy Burton Brown. Because, for instance, all these same organizations, Denver Gazette, Colorado Politics, Complete Colorado, Colorado Sun, they're all reporting on this somewhat obscure executive committee request that the Colorado Republican Party endorse Trump, right? They're all reporting on that, which is like, who cares? I mean, frankly, and it's not even done. It's just a request, right? And which may or may not happen. But so it's not like they're not in the know about what's going on. And it's not like they don't want to report on what's going on. But in this case, they're just totally ignoring this financial complaint against Christy Burton Brown. And it's curious to me about why would you want to protect Christy Burton Brown? Why would you want to ignore grassroots Coloradans and kind of lump Christy Burton Brown in the same category, frankly, as the Democrats, don't you think?
Well, not to say it again, but I predicted it was radio silence when I saw the email from Davis. I said, no, they won't report on this. They'll hide it. And the only thing they have reported on to date was Raw Story, which is a very left-wing publication. And they gave the Christy Burton Brown view of it, that, you know, this is ridiculous. No, the party was great when I left it. And
did she comment to them?
She commented to
Colorado Times reporter from before.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So, I mean, it's pretty clear that they can't figure out how to. And the Raw Story did, which is a national left wing, you know, minor site.
Right.
And everything was in Christie's favor. I mean, everything. The treasure went to 9/11. Went to the Trump rally and everything else. So I don't think they know quite where to go with it. And so why not just ignore it all together, which is what I assume they would do. Because no matter if they reported, even in the most favorable terms to Christy Burton Brown, it doesn't sound good
neither
for her nor Advance Colorado. Were all the sycophants to Christy Burton Brown.
Right. Yeah. I mean, because you're right. At a certain level, she's got two choices. She can either just give them all of the stuff, right? Or she can get herself an attorney and
she will get herself.
Well, I know she'll get. Well, and I'm going to go with Brownstein. I'm going to go with the Brownstein law firm, Chris Murray, perhaps, who wasn't part of all of this.
No, they won't because of
that conflict of interest.
Not a conflict. They could be a witness.
Okay. But at any rate.
I don't think they do it, but hey, you never know.
You never know. So that's what's going on there. And we will keep you posted on what happens there. Because, I mean, December 27th, that's a deadline. I mean, and I guess that means you're the lawyer. So does that mean she has to respond in some way, shape, or form? Or what happens if she just ignores it? Because as you said, She doesn't, it's not a subpoena, so she doesn't have to hand it over. What would be if you're, 'cause my guess would be she'll ignore it, right?
Yes.
And so then what does Randy do?
Nothing. And let until and unless they file a lawsuit.
Okay.
And then they request it as part of discovery.
Okay. And I guess so this would kind of fuel that fire, right? This is sort of like giving her a chance to settle this nicely. Is that sort of fair to say?
No, I think that went down the drain a long time
Okay.
ago. I mean, early on they asked her, hey, what's this? What's that? She goes, I don't know. It got
Okay.
me, you.
This maybe just gives them a deadline. It's like, okay, if she doesn't respond by the 27th, then we
Yeah,
decide what to
then they
do.
decide whether they want to bring legal action in the
Well,
form
Dave
of a
indicated
lawsuit.
they clearly were going to.
Well, no, that's not
he
it.
said we're going to ask. That's a good point. He signaled that that was
Potentially, that is
that their
what
intent.
would happen. So she doesn't have to do anything. But if she destroys records and they can prove she destroyed records, well, then that would be a problem for her, at least civilly.
Right. So anyway, so a lot that's very interesting. Another thing, like I said, if you've just joined us, we're waiting to get Bruce Gilley. He's a political science professor at Portland State University. I'm talking about a massacre of history, is what he calls it, in the Colorado in the History Colorado's exhibit of the Sand Creek Massacre, and what they're trying to teach our
And
kids.
I have become by osmosis a little bit of a quasi semi expert on Sand Creek because I wrote a book with David Hallas, who was the historian at the Colorado History Museum. And I worked with him for over a decade on things. And as a practical matter, all I heard about was Sand Creek, and all I saw were the early exhibits and his explaining things to me. So it'll be interesting to hear
Well, and
his.
speaking, now we do have Bruce Gilley
All
here.
right.
Bruce Gilley says, hey, Bruce, Julie Hayden, Chuck
Hi,
Marienbel here. Hey there, thank you. We were kind of doing a little bit of an introduction with you. Political science professor, Portland State University, and you had a great column up in AM Greatness talking about a massacre of history in Colorado regarding the History Colorado Sand Creek Massacre exhibit.
and I was telling
Yeah, I
Julie
thought that's a
that.
little topical for you guys in Colorado.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Well,
well,
and
I was
worse with
saying,
Chuck.
Chuck, because I am a by osmosis, a quasi nerdy expert on Sand Creek, because I wrote a book with David Hallas, who was the historian for the Colorado History Museum. And
Yeah.
so I was over there a great deal of time, and his raison d'etre was Sand Creek and the exhibits and everything else. And so I watched him meet with tribal leaders, and they came up, this exhibit they originally came with it goes back 20 years, 30 years, and it's always, before it was X, and then it got to be a little more on the indigenous side, and then they totally decided in this last one to shovel any non-indigenous outlook on it to give a wonderfully non-nuanced view of a controversial subject.
Well, and I guess it might have been just like launch right into it there, Bruce. And why don't you explain what are some of the, like you said,
What is the Sand Creek
the only
Massacre?
victim here is, or the main victim here is history. Yeah, why don't you kind of enlighten us with what they showed, what the
Well,
truth
what
is?
is, just
Yeah.
tell, and then what they showed, or whatever order you
Yeah, well,
want.
Sand Creek, as you probably explained to your listeners, was a case where a territorial militia of volunteers that had been raised in Colorado during the Civil War, because one of the two regiments was away fighting, was pressed into service. There were negotiations going on with the Cheyenne and Arapaho Indians, which had been engaging in series of atrocities and massacres of settlers and farms over the preceding summer and fall, which had led Denver to the verge of starvation. And, miscalculation, misunderstanding, confusion, fear, all of that stuff went into it. And at a certain point, the militia attacked an Indian camp at what is now Sand Creek. And some number of Indians were killed. I think John Broome, or sorry, Jim Broome, who I think has done probably the most kind of forensic analysis of this, thinks that 67 or 69 Indians were killed on that day. The official figure out of the federal inquiries was always 150 to 200. And then at a certain point during the latest History Colorado exhibition, it was up to 230. And why that is, I'm not sure.
Well, the same
I've never
reason
seen the
why they
document.
Gaza Hospital was 500 because it makes a better
sounds
story.
Worse, yeah.
The more you.
But you're saying there's no, as far as you know, there's no historical basis.
Well, they didn't even know where the Sand Creek Massacre occurred exactly when David Howes was doing it. And they had a whole geological thing trying to find, you know, because massacres don't naturally lead to little monuments. So to put the monument there, they had to do all this kind of geological and other kind of surveying to find out where the Sand Creek Massacre actually was, where the Indian encampment.
Yeah, they didn't find it till 1999.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So when I was working with David, you know, he was kind of going, oh, we got to go down there and we got to do this and we got to do that. So that was very much, you know, people think it would be easy, but really dying of scores of people occurs lots of times for natural and other natural reasons. And so it took a lot of geological work to find the site and the skeletons and all of that.
And so the reopened exhibit of 2022, I guess, is when it reopened, and now finally starting to get the sort of adulatory coverage in the mainstream media in 2023, you know, essentially decided that history as such is nonsense, and we're just going to tell this story of peaceful, spiritual Indians sitting around macrameing baskets and terrible white people coming with no provocation and no reason and no individuality, just representatives of this great, terrible thing called the white races, massacring them, all of which showing, you know, that America's a terrible place. It's a complete farce. And the interesting thing is a lot of historians who work on this have privately written to me since I wrote that and said, thank you for saying that, because we can't say that ourselves because we'll lose access and we'll lose our positions and whatnot. But thank you for saying that because we actually agree with you.
Oh, well, I mean, let me get to that in a second, but that's maybe shed a little bit of light, because historically, I mean, I was unaware. I mean, having lived in, you know, I didn't grow up here, but lived in Colorado, I was vaguely aware. And in general, my sense was exactly what you said, that for greedy land grabbing reasons, the white settlers went in, massacred the Indians, took over their camp and built houses. And now it's Denver, right?
A little off on geography.
Well, but I mean, essentially, you know,
it's still kind of vacant land.
But I mean, that's sort of my sense. But you were talking about, I mean, I had never heard of this before. You're saying, like, in, for instance, the Indians, in one instance, they killed like a family and left them on the steps of the city and county building.
Well, no. So this is the Hunsdale family, and it was, I think it was the most dramatic kind of case of an Indian atrocity, because this was a family that had been there. They're not recent arrivals. The basically defenseless mother and her children attacked, scalped, mutilated. So the territorial government, or some of the sort of ones who wanted a harder line on protecting Denver from the Indians, brought their bodies and put them on display. So that was not done by them, but by the settlers. And but you know, the whole point is that you know, the settlers at the time felt very insecure, not surprisingly, because the atrocities had been happening every, you know, few weeks, a dozen or two dozen settlers or stagecoach hands or whatever left dead, you know, the horses plundered, of course. And, you know, it had only been a few years since the all-Indian uprising in Minnesota, which had left 700 dead. Yeah. And there was talk of a similar one in Colorado. Now, we can say, you know, well, we know in retrospect that, you know, this didn't come together. But, you know, at the whole point of history is to try and take ourselves out of our present comforts and put ourselves into the position of people in different aspects of a historical episode and try and understand. That's what history is. And there's no attempt at understanding in this new History Colorado Center exhibit.
Well, the one thing that surprised me in my osmosis understanding of the Sand Creek Massacre is how controversial it was in Denver at the time. There were lots of people, lots of Denverites that found the massacre outrageous. Now, Chevington, who's heading the volunteer force, had his own supporters and all that, but it was highly controversial and highly condemned by some segments of the society, which is sort of amazing because, you know, it's a very European sense of warfare that you just send your young men out. The two young men fight it with directed by the old people, and whoever wins, they take the territory, but they leave the civilian population, the old people, alone. Generally speaking, that's not how warfare works. And where, let's say, in 1099, when the Crusaders went down the First Crusade and reached Jerusalem, they just slaughtered everybody. You know, it is a butchery because that wasn't in Europe and they weren't Europeans. But certainly in Indian warfare, they certainly viewed women and children either as targets or alternatively as bounty.
Yeah.
You take the women and children, you enslave them, and otherwise, you know, you could marry them. They weren't very racist back then, at least the Indians weren't, so that, you know, but women and children were considered part of the war. If you killed them, you enslaved them, but you just didn't simply leave them alone. And that's a very European war concept.
Right. So the funny thing is, if you think about it, you know, what Shivington did with his militia was actually to completely conform to Indian norms of warfare.
Right.
And he was in that sense very culturally competent in his warmongering.
Except they weren't willing to enslave the Indians. You know, they were racist. And so you couldn't bring the women back to your homestead and sell them off or have the kids work on your farm. I mean, at least they just slaughtered them. There was no slavery involved, and the Indians were more enlightened in that in some cases they would enslave them.
So I think the bigger point is history as such is over in the United States as far as mainstream treatments of historical issues. There's no history anymore. It's just ideological propaganda with certain groups identified as those who will be written into history as the virtuous victors and certain who will be written into history as the horrible losers. All they've done compared to, you know, past traditions of that sort of historiography is just invert who the winners and losers are and who the victors and the vanquished are. But it's nonetheless just propaganda the way Henry VIII or the Chinese emperors used to write history.
Well, and you made a good point in your column. I mean, this is this History Colorado. I mean, this is school kids go there and this is how they're learning history, right? I mean, you mentioned that some of the kids' perceptions. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was reading the accounts, of course, the glowing accounts from the Denver Post and whatnot of how wonderful this is for the kids. And, you know, one of the one quotation I use is, you know, this 17-year-old girl who comes out and says, "I'm so angry at history." Well, how is that in any remote sense indicating a successful exhibit? If the child comes out and says, "I hate history," that I'm just going to be in a constant rage against the past for the rest of my life, and my only response to the past is going to be this blind rage. I mean, how is that education in any sense of the word?
No.
What is, and this is a trick question, what is the right thing a child should come out from this exhibit?
Well, a child should understand, first and foremost, always come out with an understanding of the humanity of all the parties involved. This is the most fundamental lesson that we need to teach kids about history, that we are no better than the people in the past. And if you consider yourself a human being who deserves empathy and understanding from others for how you live your life, then for God's sake, history needs to teach us empathy and understanding for the individuals involved in historical episodes, no matter what side they're on. And I mean that all across the board, right? There's very few instances where we want to say we don't care about that person, even if they're on the side of a cause that we think is deeply unjust and deserves condemnation. So that's the first thing. And that's, of course, the first failure of this exhibit is there's no humanizing of the non-Indians involved in this story, whether soldiers, whether settlers, whether governors, whether free slaves who were part of the Colorado militia and regiment. None of these people are humanized. And certainly the federal inquiries, the white male federal government leaders who did so much work on these inquiries, none of them are humanized either.
Well, and you know.
Well, but here's my response to that. And it is a realization that I came to in fifth grade, fourth grade, whatever it was. If you really drill down, you end up that human beings are not nice. They're really bloodthirsty, awful people. And not and and the reason you can avoid that conclusion of misanthropy is that you consider some good and others bad. You have to, you know, unless you want to kind of go, God, human beings are a bloodthirsty, awful group. You have to say, no.
Only
It
one
was
of the
the
groups.
white settlers, or it was the savage Indians. Human beings have been able to avoid the fact that they are a disgusting
No, I'm not saying
species.
I look at this
No,
differently.
it's true. It's true. Look through the history of the world. And from the Holocaust to today, you know, I mean, what the Sand Creek Museum did, or I mean, the history of Colorado, is they took Israel and Gaza and went from October 9th or October 8th on. You never saw why the Israelis went in and started slaughtering Hamas. You only go where after the Israelis invaded. And that's what they did. They said, okay, let's not go into before whatever date it was in 1864. We're only go after that date. All the atrocities before are ignored, and we just look at this. And that's necessary for innocence of people. People must believe they are not the awful species that we are,
No.
and
Okay.
accept the awful
No.
species where we are. See, Julie does not
No,
believe
that's just
any
like
of this.
Bruce talk, Chuck. That's like
Well,
Bruce
no, I
talk.
told him, I let him give his thing, and I just wanted to give my response. So what's your response? My response.
I want to hear what Julie has to say.
Oh no! Oh, that was
I
tricky.
think
That was tricky.
that
No wonder you go from Portland State.
Chuck cherry picks historical examples. I think you could also go through history and pick out many examples, even being unbiased about it, of people doing good things.
Yahoo.
And I think it goes, Bruce, you made a very good point. The truth is that we're all
You're smart, Bruce. Bring in Julie.
wait, no.
That was a
All
good
right,
move.
that's but I think anyway, the point though that I want to talk about is something you made earlier, and that is,
I still want his response.
okay, are people good or bad or both?
Well, I think all people are a mixture of motives. Obviously, some people are better than others, but you know, I don't think I disagree. I could tell a story that humanity is the most incredibly good and fine species and you know ever, and put people in a situation and they will act like angels unless they're given an act and a reason to act like devils. But whatever, however you want to call it, glass half full, glass half
Humans are
empty. That the
devils.
second point that a history exhibition should show is the forces in which people operate their lives, which is, you know, we call that whatever you want to call it, history, call it structure, call it whatever. But the fact is, we all find ourselves in situations not of our making. And the second thing that a history exhibit needs to do is to show what those situations are, what those forces are, what those economic and social and technological and cultural and political factors are that create situations in which people act. And again, this exhibit totally fails that. It tells us nothing about the run-up to this. It tells nothing about the settlement of the West, about the migration of these tribes out of South Dakota because they were fleeing tribal conflicts. It tells us none of that. And that's, again, that's what history has to tell us, is why people found themselves in situations and where those situations came from.
No. Well, and what's interesting too, I want to go to something you said, and that is you had people writing you saying, thank you for saying that. I couldn't say that because I could, I mean,
Well, how do you get to say it? I mean, Portland State is infamous for being a liberal college. How do you get to give this message out?
because I don't work on indigenous or Indian issues. I'm not an archaeologist who requires tribal consent to go do a dig. I'm not an anthropologist who needs tribal consent to go and study their culture. I'm not a historian who needs access to their records or the records held by the federal government that they demand a veto over. You know, I'm none of that. So unless you're in a committed relationship with the indigenous people, then you can say what you want.
And what do you make of that? I mean, to me, you could go all the way through, to COVID. I mean, so much anymore, and it's kind of astonishing the way it has, and I guess, encroached into history. But there's only certain narratives that people are allowed to say out, are allowed to say out loud anymore. And it's just pervasive, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the people who should have the most untrammeled ability to follow the truth where it leads them and to articulate what they think is the truth, full stop, should be people in higher education. I mean, it's supposed to be a special place where, you know, your organization, your employer commits first and foremost to your free speech. That's not true of every, you know, it's not true of a company. A company absolutely can tell its employees, you know, don't go promote the other brand, you know, while you're at the office. I mean, that's totally fine. But higher education is supposed to be the place where, you know, the ability to speak truth, no matter the consequences or the popularity, is the highest principle. And it's been lost for people studying these types of issues.
Well, and you know what's really sad about that, too, is, OK, so at least people like you and people like Chuck and the man that you worked with, you know, there is this other side. But going back to that kid who was interviewed coming out saying, I'm so angry at history. So that kid now has no idea even there's another side. And then her children will be raised. You know what I mean? It's sort of like.
No, David was not allowed to say the other side.
But
he was absolutely
he at least knew
not.
It. He at least knew
well,
there was another side.
Well, he recognized it. I promise you. He worked with the tribes. He was their liaison. And you could not ever get, you know, there was nothing good about Shivington. Nothing. And others would kind of go, well, he was a monster, but he also had his other thing. He's a pastor. He was lots of things. But no, David could not acknowledge the settler side of the story.
Well, and also keep in mind, it's always important to keep in mind that what the so-called Native Americans, because don't forget, we don't have any third-party affirmed DNA testing for anyone who claims Indian ancestry, right? And
right. The
reason for that is because we know that probably half of them are actually Hispanic, and the other half of them have less than 10% Native blood, if you took the numbers, right? So let's just be clear that when they say this is the indigenous perspective of 2023,
right,
it bears only the faintest relationship to what the actual Cheyenne and Arapaho people would have thought about this circa 1864-65, right? I mean, let's not take this idea that they represent anything other than a particularly odd group of people circa 2023 making certain claims and being given the right to make those claims. But let's not say that that's in any way a historically accurate reflection of what those people thought at the time.
Well, yeah. I watched the archivist. So I watched back in the early 1990s, in which the tribal leaders were thrilled that anybody would talk to them at all, because they were, well, how are we at Sand Creek? What are you talking about? Up until, I last saw David, but, in the 2008, 2009, where they were very demanding. They knew, you must tell our side of the story as we interpret it. And then they literally, this is literally true, they would literally make up stuff. And then they'd say, no, that's our oral tradition. I remember now that, my great-great-grandmother told me X or Y. And you could never disprove it, of course, because it's,
oral tradition.
It's oral tradition. But boy, they went from very meek and grateful to being consulted to very demanding. And it was amazing to watch.
Right. And again, just because, why is that? Because they're different people. They're not different people. They're the exact same people. What has changed is the system in which they operate and the incentives given to them.
Right.
So is there...
Exactly. That's well put. That's well put.
Just and just a couple more questions.
Oh, we want a couple more. Let's keep on going. This is great. It's so great to have this guy on. Honestly.
Well, Chuck, I told you, Bruce, when you called, Chuck is a history guy. Is there hope? I mean, what I was going with my question there was, so like I said, at least you guys know that there was another side, even if you can't say it. But the girl who came out of that exhibit has no idea there is another side, probably no desire to access it. But you know what I mean? So it seems like that the truth gets more and more and more sort of warped and farther away.
Yeah. And it's basically what happened in the Soviet Union and the Communist Party system. And it's what happened to China as well, which is that the official history becomes so complex, and it becomes a sort of, it's all so hard to keep it all together because, you know, people who were previously in favor in the official history suddenly become out of favor, and the history has to be rewritten. And what happens is people get cynical about history. They treat history as simply a mandate that's coming from somewhere else. They start to distrust history and historians. They start to do what's called decoding, which is, you know, if you hear an official history, you start to try and figure out what's really being said and what's not being said. You're engaged in what's called decoding because you don't trust it. You know it's right. Made up. So you're looking for that secret code that'll tell you what the history actually is. And, you know, what happened in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe is people became really, really cynical about the past and about the writing and telling of the past. And that's, you know, I don't know, maybe that's what the contemporary elites want. They want just a vast cynicism, but it's certainly not creating a sense of curiosity about history.
Well, yeah. you know, you were talking Henry VIII and the Tudors. The Tudors totally changed history, and they, you know, took Richard III and the Plantagenets, and they made them viewed as evil. And certainly, as I was studying English history, I learned the Tudor version of history. And you know, there was another side. And it's interesting, everybody who were the anti-Tudors after a while said, you know, Richard III was not a hunchback. That's all BS. And they dig up his burial ground. And all of a sudden, he is a huge hunchback. So, you know, history is a strange thing. And it's always, you always have to understand that there are lots of truths in history and lots of ways to look at it. And as long as you have an open mind, you can sort of figure out kind of what the competing sides are. But most people do not see the competing sides. They have one side of history. They're happy with that. They're happy with the awful settlers, and they'll have that for the rest of their life.
Yeah, but as long as history and changes in historical writing are driven by facts and changes in, you know, new facts, new interpretations, new theories that better fit the facts. I mean, that's science, right? So nobody is cynical about science when science goes.
Well, they should be these days. They should be.
Yeah, well, no, but basic right. Stuff like, you know, fusion is not possible, and now we think fusion is possible. That's not because some political shift. It's because the science got better, and so, you know, our theories changed. So that's supposed to be the way we approach history too. So there's nothing wrong with history changing as the scientific study of history improves our understanding. But when history changes because new groups come in and out of fad and ideological imperatives that history is supposed to serve change, now that's what creates cynicism.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and one of our listeners, one of our listeners is mentioning that here in Colorado, they're going through a thing. They want to rename Mount Evans.
Yes,
they want to rename
the governor.
Yeah, the governor wants to call it Mount Blue Sky, which nobody likes. But
sure.
But it's, which is sort of, like you said, erasing history, because now no one's going to ever be like, well, why do we call it Mount Evans?
Right.
Right.
He was the governor at the time of the Sand Creek Massacre.
Right. I mean, so, and I mean that.
And founded DU.
Yeah, yeah. So you would think, well, he must have had some good qualities, and like, nope.
Well, that's to me the thing about, you know, and if I had to say whether I'm a cynic or not, I guess I am. oh, thank you, Julie.
I'm rolling my eyes, Bruce. I'm rolling my eyes at that.
But history does make you, it does, as reading of the Bible does, it makes you very skeptical about the human soul, and you understand why we are a very flawed group, but that's just me.
Well, anything else? Are you working on any other history stuff?
What else
I know
working on?
You're political and global, political science and global things, but anything else fun that where people can look for and find your writings?
Well, I think my book that just came out is called The Case for Colonialism, and that's actually what I've been talking mostly about on media recently, and it's basically bringing together writings and new work I've done that expands upon an academic article I wrote in 2017 called The Case for Colonialism that brought a global mob down on my head.
I bet.
The book is called The Case for Colonialism, and it just came out with New English Review Press in November. And it covers both, you know, European colonialism in Africa and Asia, as well as United States and Canada settler colonialism under the British Empire here.
Listen, can we? Because I know I would
well,
be intrigued.
I can promise
you back to talk about that.
I can promise you I'll buy the book. I can get it at Amazon everywhere else, can I? Hopefully.
Sure. Yep.
Okay.
I'll read the book and we'll have you back on. But you've been great. I really enjoyed the discussion.
Fantastic.
All right. Thank you, Bruce. And again, we were sidetracked by the Sand Creek, by your column there, because that just sort of hits home here in Colorado. So if you'll come back, we'd love to have you. And meanwhile, thank you for your time. And have a, this is our Party Friday. So
you're part of Party Friday.
Have a happy
that
party.
That part
Friday.
Of history you're a part of.
Bruce, thank Fantastic. You so much for your time. All right.
Take
thank
care,
you,
Bruce.
Sir. Bruce,
thank
good
you.
And I do recommend, guys, if you have any, it's Bruce, G-I-L-L-E-Y, and it was in AM Greatness. Just, I think it was a couple of days ago. Yeah, exactly.
Case for Colonialism.
Which we can't talk about anymore.
I'm going to read it. I'm going to go out this weekend. I'm going to get various other books and read it, and we'll have him back on. He's great.
That's right. And now, regardless, he took, because we were only late with him.
He took up all this time.
Chuck loves the history.
Oh, my God.
Talk about, I'm just going to briefly mention, and then I'll get a great soundbite to wrap it up.
You better the soundbite, you better get on there.
Lauren Boebert, what went into her head? We liked Lauren Boebert, now we don't. So she votes to reauthorize FISA spying on President Trump.
No.
Well, she did.
Well, because you have a choice. Either you get a bill through the House, and therefore you have some Republican things, or you don't, in which the government just keeps on doing it.
You're saying it's not fair to judge her on one.
No, it really isn't. I mean, I understand if I were in Congress, I'd vote against it, but I'm obstinate. I can understand when I said, look, we did the best we could. Yes, FISA gets extended for 4 months, and ultimately, you know, they have to spy on us and destroy us.
Right.
But it is, if you know, the trouble with politics, and what's the awful part about politics, is compromise. And the question is it a good compromise or a shitty compromise? And I think you could make the case that it's an okay compromise.
Okay.
And so I don't really blame her. I mean, because she had to vote for 702 by itself.
Although he was upset about
that.
Well, that
shows you.
This is kind of funny. You guys, I'm sure you've noticed, as Donald Trump increasingly takes the lead, not only looking like he'll be the Republican candidate, but the mainstream media is freaking out because it's looking more and more like he could actually win. You're right. And so they're freaking out. And the stuff they are saying, I mean, I don't know where they're going to go with the stuff they're saying by the time it actually gets to the general election. But I wanted to play you, this is just a little clip of some of the Trump derangement stuff that they're saying in the mainstream media. Thomas, if we could please play the Trump derangement soundbite.
What would a second Donald Trump term look like?
Well, he cannot be the next president. Because if he is,
you can't imagine the things that he's going to do. Mexico, Canada. We can't go to Canada because eventually Canada will become annexed to America
and shoot visitors to the White House.
Yeah, that means he can shoot the First Lady.
We're going to see violence, the likes of which we didn't even see on January 6th.
Make it illegal to run against him, to throw his opponents in jail, to shut down the media.
He will make himself into the Fuhrer, and he will make everybody raise their hand and salute him.
Using martial law against the American people.
Terminate the Constitution.
To rewrite the Constitution.
Create mass internment camps.
Throw everyone into Gitmo.
Might be sent to jail, or their rights might be suppressed, especially minority groups in society.
You might have any number of things happen to you and your family.
Every one of us, our freedom, our liberty, none of us is safe.
He's going to have people around him executing against an enemy's list.
Assassinate generals.
Ordering troops to attack American citizens.
Trump's very well-armed and extremist base will try to kill people.
He's going to basically burn the house down.
He will unravel the institutions of our democracy.
So, I mean, it's like it goes on. And you know, ironically, many of those things are things that they're doing, right? Like,
shoot us.
Right, exactly. Wow. Exactly. Exactly. Hey, this comment, you know, Jim Jackson, this sort of sums it up of talking about about history. Read history and take it with a few grains of salt until you determine the philosophy of the author. That's absolutely right. And we'll have him back on to talk about the colonialism. Guys, that's going to wrap
I'll probably agree with a lot of he says in that.
That's going to wrap it up for us on this Party Friday. On Monday, we're going to have Colonel John Mills on, and he's going to be talking about this FISA reauthorization and the FISA warrants. Yeah, and sort of like what the deep state is doing to us.
Right.
In the meantime, I want to thank Thomas, all of our guests, all of you great guys on Zoom. Remember, all of the shows you can get at chuckandjulie.com. We are off. Chuck had lunch with friends. He may have started Party Friday a little bit early.
Which is good.
And I'm going to do my best to catch up.
Yeah,
so,
and she's very good at that.
Everyone have a wonderful.
Hey, have a great time and get your Christmas shopping done. Don't procrastinate like me.
We'll see you on Monday.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.